very persons which provide for his sense gratification, he hesitates. Thus, by the will of Krishna, Arjuna falls into illusion and refuses to fight because of family attachment. Illusion and depression are some of the results of not following the instructions given in mantras 6 and 7 of Sri Ishupanishad. Okay, so now here we're dealing with what will be introduced will naturally be the ideal or the standard. What would be the standard, what would be the proper behavior? So then here this the vision of these realized souls then would be given. Is that if they see everything in connection to Krishna, then there'll be no anxiety or no hate, right? Hatred comes up when there's a frustration of one's own attachments. You have something, then that can't be fulfilled, then there's hate. Right? Otherwise, that doesn't arise. Hatred doesn't arise. And anxiety will be there because of a lack of security, because whatever is your field of activities, something is wrong with it. And because of that, then you will not be able to gain what it is you're looking for. Right? If something's the field of activities, by dealing with that, that's how you get your results. Right? So whatever you have of interest, whatever you have of desire, is all in that field. Right? There's not something separate from you, the field of activity. Whatever it is that's important to you, that's the field. Right? Or anything connected with that to make that function, that's your field of activity. So if there's something that is not working in there, or something you're unsure about, that will create insecurity, so that creates anxiety. Yes.
Is the dissatisfaction or frustration which arises from not being able to perform one's service, one's spiritual duty, is that also material and detrimental, or can that be an impetus for spiritual advancement? Sometimes it borders also to hatred, because when there is obstacles or aversion in one's service.
Means that there is a anxiety to be able to perform a service for Krishna, then that's nice, that part's good. But the actual insecurity or the hatred, that's still mundane, like that. The general point, I mean, other than those two, but that worry that you cannot perform the activity, that's nice. But it should never create a feeling of disconnection from Krishna or an alienation with the devotees, because it's just a matter of they're the instruments for dealing with some aspect of our own anarthas. So then, because otherwise, if it's not an anartha, it won't bother you. You know what I'm saying? I mean, if something that's of value to you, if that is disturbed, then you get upset. But if it's something you couldn't care less about, you know, like that, then, you know, if let's say we brought in, you know, found a waste piece of paper on the floor and picked it up and said, you know, we're going to rip this in half, it's kind of like, you know, so what, you know? But if it was something of value, you know, then that would create the difficulty. So then what happens is the modes of nature then arrange that either those persons who are able to, how you say, appropriately deal in that area of attachment or anxiety, then they are involved in your field of activity, like that. And so then if you get disturbed, then you know that there's something wrong there, something weak there. But if you don't get disturbed, you know, in an area where you would, then that means that's an improvement. So the idea is that it's just like, let's say you have a math class, so then the test will be on mathematics, it won't be on history. Right? So the idea is that whatever it is that needs to be, whatever is your conditioned nature, whatever is your values, that is what then you're tested on. Because your test will be different from someone else's. Right? So for you, one thing doesn't matter, so you're not tested there. You're tested where it does matter, like that. So then they're simply an instrument, actually, for that. You know, so it does, but them being the instrument that they took part in it doesn't mean that they get any good credit for that. You know, in other words, Krishna is showing you that you still have anarthas in a particular way. So in that way you could say, and you were able to appreciate that and move forward. So technically, in one sense, it's not exactly that they are getting the benefit. It means that they took part and you were benefited by that, and if you are a well-wisher of them, despite them, whatever they do to you, then they will get benefit from it. But otherwise, they get the reaction to bad behavior, like that. So that's why one doesn't have to. One is an instrument, but one still is responsible for having taken part as an instrument. You know what I'm saying? So this whole idea is that I just take off one hat and put on another hat, and therefore I'm not responsible for any breakage of relationships or what's done. That doesn't fly in real life. You know, it's not so easy. Well, oh, I was just wearing my management hat. That's why I said all those things about you and completely rip you to shreds and everything like that. But now I've taken that hat out and I put back on my I'm your friend hat. And so now everything's just perfectly normal like it was before. That works in the modern society of illusion, where they don't know what relationship is. They don't even have them. You know, it's something they've heard of. You know, it's like that. In the storybooks, they're there. But they don't know, so they'll do stuff. But they actually get a reaction for that. If you behave badly in etiquette, it doesn't matter how you are, you get a reaction. That's why even the advanced devotees are very, very careful about, you know, Vaishnava etiquette. Because even though they may be uttamadhikaris, still it doesn't mean there won't be a reaction if they do something against etiquette. Yeah, so this point is being brought out is that now we're working on the attitude. So in all this issue, the Upanishads are going to work more on attitude, right? Because they are dealing with gyan, right? Their forum is gyan, right? The Brahmanas, the forum is karma, right? So your Dharma Shastras, your Griha Sutras, all these different things, they're going to be working on karma. How to connect karma to Krishna, right? But the Upanishads, being Uttaramimamsa, they're going to work on gyan, right? So the Dharma Shastras and all, I mean, the Brahmanas are going to work on Dharma Artakama, how that connects to the Lord. And then the Upanishads are going to work on moksha, how that connects to the Lord, right? So then all the aspects of human nature are taken care of. So in this, then we see is not so much emphasis is put on or detail is given in the way of what activity is to be performed. It's taken that someone on the platform of gyan already understands what they should do, right? Just in a line of that, we'll read a quote here from Ishupanishad, in the second. This is from the second mantra, purport. In the Bhagavad Gita 3.9.16, the Personality of Godhead says that one cannot attain the state of Naishkarmya without executing the prescribed duties mentioned in the Vedic literature. Like that. Oh, so much for political correctness. This literature can regulate the working energy of a human being in such a way that he can gradually realize the authority of the Supreme Being. When he realizes the authority of the Personality of Godhead, Vasudeva, or Krishna, it is understood that he has attained the stage of positive knowledge. In this purified stage, the modes of nature, namely goodness, passion, and ignorance, cannot act, and he is able to work on the basis of Naishkarmya. such work does not bind one to the cycle of birth and death. So that's what's being mentioned here, is that it means you're already executing the prescribed duties of the Vedic literature, right? Krishna is saying that you perform your duties, right? That's the first thing he's saying to Arjuna, because he's saying, I won't fight. So the first thing to establish, no, you have to perform your duties, right? But only in the performance of those duties can you come to Naishkarmya. Because otherwise, Naishkarmya means you're doing an activity not for your own purpose, but for the purpose of the Lord. But if you're not choosing a Vedic, what's given in the Vedic literatures as far as duty, then what would be the reason that that has been chosen? Does that make sense? It means that you take up the duties given by Shastra. That means it's a neutral state, right? You're taking it up. That's the position. Now you could take it up because you want to be, you want the results, or you're taking it up because you don't want the results. But in any case, you can choose between those two, because it's Vedic literature, it's the dictates of the Lord. But now if you take up another duty, right, you make up your own duties, where is that coming from? So it's come because of your own conditioned nature, your own interests, your own needs. Therefore, its principle is not neutral. Its principle is sakam. Right? So now to take that sakam and work with it on nishkam, then you can try, but the basis of it is nishkam. You know what I'm saying? So it won't have the same effect as if it has been authorized by the Vedic literatures. Because that right there is just that it's authorized by authority means its basis is nishkam. Though you can use it for sakam. But that's not its natural position. So therefore, Prabhupada's saying here is that one cannot attain the state of naishkarma without executing the prescribed duties mentioned in the Vedic literature. Right? So without that, how do you get to naishkarma? So that's the whole point the Upanishad is making. Here is that if that activities that you're performing are done from that platform of naishkarmya, right? Then seeing everybody and everything in connection to the Lord, then one can very easily obtain to that state. Right? Because if everything belongs to Krishna, everything is for Krishna, everything's connected to Krishna, then it makes it very difficult to see it in one's own attached state. So, therefore, one is not bound. Here is not, one's not bound by karma. Right? Because it's naishkarmya. Right? Does that make sense? But this other state means it's taking the same thing from two different angles. One is taking the action itself. If you do this action with that attitude, right? The other is just taking the attitude, because it's understood that someone who is studying Upanishads already understands the shastras that deal with karma, right? Because that's where you started, right? The brahmachari starts doing his duties and activities like that, and then he either remains a naishtika brahmachari or gets married, and then at some point he comes to this platform. So he's already expert in the performance of duties. So now the Upanishad is talking about how to view it from the platform of jnana, that you're working from naishkarmya, so your attitude is changed, right? Does that make sense? So someone who's new at the process, then you're going to start with proper performance of duty. That's why in Gita, then Arjuna's not doing his duty, so what do we start with after we've explained that there's such a thing as spiritual? Right? Then we start with karma. Right? Third chapter is karma. Then fourth chapter is the proper knowledge, this jnana. Fifth chapter is when you combine the two, is buddhi yoga. Right? But in any case, this is going on. But the Upanishad is taking it that's already understood. So the Upanishad is basically working at it from the angle of the last chapters of Gita. Right? That you're dealing with the technicalities of how to adjust your mentality so that it brings it in line with the Lord's satisfaction. Right? Does this make sense? So that's it. So you're saying? Yes.
Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada sometimes said about devotional service that it can be favorable. You do it because the Lord wants it. He wants cooking. He wants an offering. You cook. or you can cook because you like to cook, you want to cook, and that would be considered unfavorable devotional service, or unfavorable to devotional service. Same kind of thing, attitude.
Yes, well, the whole thing is attitude. It means we get from, it's brought out many, many times, though it will not necessarily be noticed, but like in the Mahabharata, then the discussion comes up, Shonaka Rishi is then explaining that you have work, and so that work must be done according to authority, then it becomes proper work. But more important than the quality of the work is the quality of the attitude. So in every action, then there's the attitude and there's the work itself. They're combined because they go together. Depending upon your attitude, you're going to do work. You know, so even if it's like, okay, well, I'm doing this Vedic stuff, but I don't really want to do it, that means you're not going to do it so well. That's based on your attitude. You know, so whatever it is that your attitude is, that's going to be the quality of your work. But in the beginning, sometimes attitude is the more subtle, so it's not so easily understandable. So you start with work, that you should do this work, because if you can't see the subtleties, you only see the gross, so therefore working with the gross will be very effective. Because if you talk subtlety, they don't know that it exists. But if you talk the action itself, then that is the field of activity of that person. By performing in that way, naturally, by the devotional process, jnana and vairag come as just an automatic, results. So with time, then they'll be able to see that work with knowledge. And by the time that comes, they'll be quite good at that work, right? Because it's by practice, by whatever you do, by practice it, then you get your understanding of it. So that will come along together. So you'll have a good understanding, and at the same time, you'd be very good at the work. So, but it's important that those two become combined, like that. There's an idea that if somebody doesn't think too much, you won't get mental. So then that will actually be better for the work. But it's not the process of thinking. It's not knowledge that's the problem. That mentalness is actually false ego. Because one is mental that one can't do it or it won't turn out good. In other words, my performance of the activity won't get a good result and my ego wouldn't be able to actually handle that. So mentalness is actually ignorance. And that's what's causing the problem. But because you're using kind of like the gray matter, then those who aren't that sharp mistake that for, you know, the same category as, you know, studying knowledge. Like that. But and saying that will make you mental. But it's the work that made them mental. It's the karma that made them mental. But if they have knowledge, then they won't be in anxiety, right? Because mentalness means anxiety. So the Upanishad is saying here that if they understand all living entities as parts and parcels of the Lord, he won't feel any anxiety or any hatred. So then that's because why here the focus on the living entity? Because that's actually what's going on. Most of the time we were thinking of, you know, your work or this or that, because we're looking at the grosser aspect. But how does work happen? Right? I'm trying to get, let's say, a post. And so there's some discussions and devotees and all this and that. And so then, because someone kind of like said something or did something, I didn't get the post. Someone else got it. Or in any case, even if someone else got it, that doesn't matter. I didn't get it. That's the working principle, the essential point. Right? So now, in that, I will be seeing the field of activities, right? And this field didn't work very nicely for me. Right? But in actuality, what happened? Did the field operate itself? No, it was activated by living entities. So technically, if you really want to understand the field of activities, you have to understand living entities. Right? Living entities, like the jivas are living entities. Maya is a person, right? Krishna is a person. Paramatma is a person. We're a person. So it's actually people who are doing all this. So that's why if you see all living entities as parts and parcels of the Lord, then all the problem goes away, right? So this is how the Upanishad, it'll approach that. So we'll say the Upanishad is more dry, right? Because it's more philosophical. But actually, it gets right to the essence, which is people. Right? While the other shastras, even though it seems more personal, because it's dealing with your activities and your emotions and your attachments and all these things, actually it's dealing more with dead matter. This is the fun. Right? It's interesting to note, when Bhaktivinoda Thakur is always establishing the process, especially in, he's establishing the principles of love of Godhead, prayojana, you know, all the stuff about rasa and all that, the verses that he quotes are all from Upanishads. Just basically, just standard, every last one. Other things he'll quote from other places, because there may not be as much of a doubt. You can quote from Gita or this or that. But in here is that then if you want to establish rasa as the ultimate, then you have to go to the ultimate authority, you know, in the case of the broad general public, and that will be Upanishad or Vedanta. You know, some may not accept Vedanta, but they'll accept Upanishads. Everybody has to accept Upanishads, right, if they accept the Vedic literature. So then he's not messing around, he just goes from there. Which is very interesting, because all the very fine points of rasa and prema he establishes with Upanishadic quotes. Right? Rather than some, you know, prayer of Kula Shekhar, this or that. That works for us. But when you're trying to establish it as a fact in a, as, you know, an open assembly, then he uses Upanishads. Which is very interesting to note, you know, like that. So it's actually is that they deal with the essence, so that means it has to be the highest. But its presentation or its forum is that of knowledge. So it uses all these technical kind of knowledge language, like that, that vocabulary. So then we take it that it must be very dry, but actually it's not. It's dealing with people. Krishna, you know, he's near, but he's very far. He walks, he does not walk. Who are they talking about? They're talking about a person. You know, and be able to distinguish between his spiritual qualities by which he acts and his lack of any material qualities. Like that. So it's very, very interesting here. So therefore they get right down to the point of seeing everything in connection to Krishna. And, you know, all living entities in connection to Krishna, the material energy in connection to Krishna. Right? And that here, when we're dealing with quota, quota means its first point is what is your duty, right? It's not the externals. It means what's the duty? What are you supposed to do? You're a brahmachari. What are you supposed to do? Therefore, as a brahmachari, what is your work that you're entitled to? What are your facilities? What is your position in society? What is your economics, right? That's your quota. That changes. The grihastha, the quota changes. Right, his field of activities is different. Right? So therefore, what he has as facility, what he has to work with in Krishna consciousness, it's a different quota. Right? Does that make sense? The brahmacharya will work with very simple, you know, in the emotional field, not very much. Some camaraderie, a few other things like that. But the grihastha can work in the full range of emotion. That's his quota. But then since it's your quota, that has to be connected to the Lord. Right? That's the whole point. Quotas are connected to the Lord, right? You know, you get a book distribution quota, then the results of that goes to who made the quota. Right? They say you have to do 100 books, the results of that goes to the temple. It does go to you. Like that. So the whole point is the quota is given by God, therefore that is the quota you have to connect to the Lord. Does that make sense? So now now that is your duties. So your quota is your duties. Right? So we're talking about these two things, the duties and the attitude. Now they're dealing with the attitude. Once they establish the Ishvasya principle of your duties, then there's the attitude in which you follow that Ishvasya principle. In other words, in which you perform your duties. And that is then, here the ideal is that seeing everything seeing everything in connection, now you see the other living entities in connection. Right? Because otherwise, what is your quota is all nouns. You may say, oh, they're people. Okay, for a grihastha, a wife is a quota. But wife is a position, it's a noun. You know what I'm saying? So you could deal with them as dead matter. You know, your money, your house, your facility, your position. So now, but attitude means you have to be dealing with people. Because if I had an attitude of naishkarmya, right? That means it's a position of I as a person, I'm not working for myself, I am working for someone else. Right? So that's the people. Right? So the field is the quota given by the Lord. Right? And the attitude is seeing all other living entities as parts and parcels of the Lord. These two are caught, then all of your activities will be fine and all your mentality will be fine. Right? So it's getting right into essence. That's the Upanishad does this. That's generally what it does. And it's very, very, it always brings it back to people. Right? Like if it discusses knowledge, then it discusses knowledge on the principle of people. Right? Remember the verse? Like that. These, what is it? Who's the lower? Who's the upper? You have the teacher and the student.
The teacher's lower.
Teacher's the lower principle, and then the
student stu-
is as the upper principle. Mm-hmm. Then the connection between them.
Knowledge.
And
lecture makes it work.
And lectures makes it work. Okay, so this is Upanishad. It gives five principles. So on vidya, then you have the teacher is the basis, right? So the student will be the active principle there, you know, or the upper principle. Then you have that what will make the two come together is knowledge, right? Because you have two parties. What joins them, right? It means what's the abhideya? And then what's the forum? That so knowledge, the forum of that, then will be through discussion, right? Through lecture. Then the process is complete. Knowledge is complete then. You have proper teacher, proper student, you have based on knowledge, and then you have the form in which that knowledge is exchanged. Right? So that's Upanishad. And that says, that is knowledge, that if you have you understand that, you understand knowledge. Right? We would say, oh, what about all the other technical points? No. That's there. Technical points are there, they're important for dealing with your duty. But as far as actually making it work and the attitude behind it, then this puts everything in place. Right? Then you know who's who, what's what, what's going on. Does that make sense? So this is Upanishad. So its essential points are always like this, personal. Like that. Does that make sense? Very, very interesting, though it's not famous in this way. That's because the Shankarites and all that who deal with this, then they propound it in another way. But this is the actual position. Okay. Yes?
Yeah. Master Kuma say that all these Upanishads and all these scriptures for intellectuals, they are actually to establish all the technicalities of relationship to that.
So, yes, they would have to because they have a weakness in that, right? Means, in other words, when you describe something, you're describing something that will either enhance because they have a strength there or a weakness. Right? Does that make sense? So as if you say the brahmachari's duty is menial service, right, and respect for his authority, why would that be given? Because he already has that? No. He's a punk kid he's a lazy punk kid. So therefore you have to establish respective authority and action, right? And what kind of action? Because he doesn't have respect, therefore it has to be menial. Do you understand? So then that is his quota, because that will then establish properly his mentality. Does that make sense? So it's always there. So like what you're pointing out, then that's a good point, is that because the jnanis have a tendency to become hard-hearted and impersonal, because of that detachment, then you have to bring the personal element into it. Right? Well, the karma, then they're very personal, But the problem is then they can't function properly because of their attachment. So they have to learn how to be detached, because otherwise they'll be so personal, it'll all be about themselves. You know what I'm saying? So for them, then in doing work, then you have to, it means you're getting benefit, everybody should get benefit. Right? Like that. And so for the jnani, because he's seeing, not being disturbed by people, but he still has to be able to see people. Otherwise he reduced people down also to things, but how you say? Not something you exploit, just something you are indifferent to. Does that make sense? Is that okay? So just on this, before we go on to the next section, a nice thing. It says here, verses 8 and 9, somehow or another, I thought this was from the Upanishad study guide, but this is from the Gita study guide. So then, here it said, it's the same kind of thing, because this is action in Krishna consciousness. So what's the third chapter? Fifth chapter. Okay, so now we've combined the activity and the knowledge. So here's transcendental loving service to Krishna is beyond the ordinary work governed by the five immediate and remote causes. The doer, the work, the situation, the endeavor, and fortune. Right? Fortune is always meaning the Lord or Paramatma there. Is that it's whatever you've done according to him, he'll sanction your work according to what you actually deserve by previous work. Because you won't remember your bad work, right? Good work we may remember, but even that sometimes we'll forget. So he remembers all that, so you get accordingly. So he says, the doer means the person performing the activity. The work itself, what specifically is being done, the situation in which that is all happening, right? That's the field, like that. The endeavor means then you're going to make how you did the work. And then, of course, ultimately it's up to the Lord. So these elements, then you can see. So the doer, the situation, and the work, that's going to be your knowledge, right? What's it? Your endeavor is going to be your focus, right? So if that you have proper knowledge, you have focus, then and you leave it up to the Lord, fortune. So all these active aspects are in place, right? Mahabharata then discusses that you have. Means if you have focus and you make endeavor, then you'll get a result, right? Of course, the result's based on the Lord, is on Daiva. But results only come if there's focus and endeavor. If you're not focused, your endeavor won't get any proper result. The better the focus, the better the result, right? So when that focus is there, it still has to be applied as endeavor, right? So if you know the doer, the work, and the situation, you know, have your focus. Right, that's what's required in focus. Then your endeavor means what you're going to do with that, and then fortune. So a person, so that's what Gita is describing as the field of activities, right? The kshetra gya. So as long as you think you are the kshetra, if you think you are the kshetra, then you're in Maya. But if you're kshetra gya, then like the Lord, you're only observer of the field. Though you only observe your field, Krishna knows all fields. Then you're not entangled in material work. Right? A person in Krishna consciousness, although he appears to be acting with his body and senses, is always conscious that he is an eternal servant of the Lord. Therefore, he is aloof from the actions of the senses. Because he knows that he is the eternal servitor of the Lord, he cannot perform any act except in the service of the Lord. Srila Prabhupada gives an example. Quote, this is from a lecture, Bhagavad Gita, on verses 7 to 14, New York, 1966. A Krishna conscious person does not think that he is accomplishing a lot. Ask him, is he going to a certain place when he has already agreed that he is going? Ask him, when are you going? And he'll say, I do not know when I shall go. But when Krishna asks me or allows me to go, then I shall go. End quote. I am saying this from my own practical experience of my Guru Maharaj, my spiritual master. He would never say, I am going, I am doing, but if Krishna desires, I shall do it. If Krishna desires, then I shall go. End quote. He always depended on Krishna. This is called Vishuddhatma. Tattva-vit means one who knows the truth. The truth is that I shall only go when Krishna allows me to go. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who is so bold and so forward, then if asked if he's doing this or that, if Krishna allows, if Krishna wants, you know, whenever Krishna, I'm only an instrument. Right? So that aspect then. Yeah. So that then is the Kshetra Gya. Right? Because he knows I'm not actually doing it. I'm observing what's happening. So if Krishna wants or Krishna allows, then I'll take part in that. You know, then we'll be the instrument for this. So then technically, from the field of activity, you are the doer. Right? You're making the endeavor. But actually, it's by the Lord's grace, under his direction. Then it's happening. So then there's no reaction. Right? Then it becomes naishkarma. Does it make sense? Right? These are all different angles of looking at the same thing. How the Gita is presenting it, how the Upanishad is presenting it. Right? Does that make sense? Because they'll be very similar, because Gita is considered Upanishad. Right? Each Upanishad will be giving basically the same points from a particular perspective. Gita takes all those and puts them together. So that's why it's considered, you know, the essence of all the Upanishads. So the Gita Upanishad. Any other questions on this? So mantras 9 to 14. Different grades of non-devotees. Right, so this is the part we'll probably all be able to relate to more. The opening of Ishupanishad, the invocation mantra, discusses the perfection and completeness of the Lord and his energies, as well as the appropriate consciousness that is to be cultivated by the human beings, Ishavasha. Mantra 3 describes the destination of those who reject to follow the Shastra injunctions. Mantras 4 to 8 elaborate on the inconceivable characteristics of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and on the qualification of the Mahabhagavat. Mantras 9 to 14 depict different grades of non-devotees and the various inauspicious results they bear. Different types of worship bring different consequences. In order to achieve success, one must know side by side the transcendental Lord and his material creation. So within 9 to 14, then verses 9 to 11 compare the different results of cultivating knowledge and indulging in ignorance. And mantras 12 to 14 evaluate the worship of the absolute truth and the worship of the relative truths. So what we see is that the Upanishad here is, there's an opening point, right? Because whenever anything opens, then the first thing is you want to establish what's actually the thesis of the work. What's the main point? Then everything else will be expansions of that. So this first point is this Ishavasya principle. That you understand this, you follow this by body, mind, and words, you will be successful. Then in the short thing it says, you know, in the third one, if you don't follow this, then there's going to be a problem, right? So then that's made the whole basis. The thesis is established. Now we go on to explain this. So then you end up with then 4 to 8 is giving the characteristics of the Lord and the devotee and their relationships. And then this 9 to 14, those who aren't devotees, then what happens, right? Same principle. You always establish what's correct first, then you show the aberration. Because otherwise, how you'll understand the aberration, that it is that way, unless you've understood what's correct first. We study what's wrong first, then what happens is we won't actually know how to judge things, because our judgment will be based on what's wrong. Right? Even if we know it's wrong, but good is compared to the wrong. Right? As opposed to, I learned what's proper first, then bad is compared to good. Right? Does that make sense? Because bad is simple. It's just not doing good. So by defining good, it's easy to define bad. Right? But if you define bad first, then good still is something completely separate. So it needs its own fully explanation. And then you'll have two seemingly different systems. Right? Therefore, you have confusion, because let us say in the area of knowledge, modern knowledge is taught first, then spiritual is gained later, when we understand that this isn't enough, something's missing. But then, much of the time, approach and understanding of the spiritual is based on the methods of the material. But the material, what's lacking is not necessarily its technicalities. That may be quite fine, but its lack of being connected to Krishna. But the technicalities have been learned not in connection to Krishna. So when you use the techniques, it will go through the techniques ultimately because Krishna is there. It will come at the end. But then the problem is during that process of knowledge, then the actual, Krishna conscious culture and taste and appreciation will be missing. Does that make sense? So the Vedic is taught first. Then, compared to that, then you can show the modern. Does that make sense? If I show you night, and then after show you day, it's kind of like, well, what's that? It doesn't matter. But if I show you day, and then, we close all the windows, that's night, then you understand, okay, when there's no light, it's dark. Because darkness is simply an absence of light. Right? So light is the standard. And you don't have the standard, then you have the other thing. Same way as that you have proper knowledge, then lacking that proper knowledge, then you have all these other kinds of knowledge, this modern knowledge. That makes sense? So we see is that the Vedas are able to describe modern very easily. If we ask somebody, explain modern, I'm sure it would be a long hoo-ha and this and that, it's very technical, and be able to tell the difference between modern and postmodern and post-postmodern and and all these different things. So people would go on and on and on. Like the impersonalists go on, well, who is God? What is God? Oh, very difficult, go on and on, right? After this PhD Sanskritist then goes on, bluffing for a while, Prabhupada turns to an 8-year-old Gurukul boy, who's God? And he says, Krishna. He says, see? Prabhupada, he knows. You know so much, you know nothing. He's not so, but he knows. So then, but in the Vedic thing, you understand what's Vedic, and that then it's very easy. Modern is simply not Vedic. That's all. You do an activity that's not based on Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. That's modern. That's all. That's all that you need, a one sentence definition. And so that can have unlimited details what it is, but the category that all the details fit into, right, all fits into this one sentence. It's just not according to the Vedas, that's all. That makes it modern. If it's according to Vedas, it's not modern. It's eternal, right? But if it's not according to the Vedas, it's temporary. So the only thing it's got going for is what's happening right now, the contemporary. And that's it. Does that make sense? Yeah. That's why then you always start with the standard. Then you do, if that doesn't work afterwards. So first we establish Ishavasya, then if you don't follow that. Then there's the devotional mentality, of worshiping the Lord properly in that way. And then if you don't have that mentality, then what happens? Right? So then this is now that section. Okay. So mantra 9. Misguided knowledge is more dangerous than nescience. Right. In mantra 9, so that's the point being made here. In mantra 9, two types of materialists are described, the materially ignorant and the materially educated. Of the two, the second group is worse. Quote, this mantra offers a comparative study of vidya and avidya. Avidya, or ignorance, is undoubtedly dangerous, but vidya, or knowledge, is even more dangerous when mistaken or misguided. Ishopanishad Mantra 9 purport. Why mistaken knowledge is more harmful than ignorance? Quote, as far as vidya is concerned, the first mantra has explained very clearly that the Supreme Lord is the proprietor of everything, and that forgetfulness of this fact is ignorance. The more a man forgets this fact of life, the more he is in darkness. In view of this, a godless civilization directed towards the so-called advancement of education is more dangerous than a civilization in which the masses of people are less educated. Right. So, means you don't see God's connection to it. So that's ignorance. And that's going to be a problem. You're going to suffer. But at least you're not opposing God's position, or actually what is the purpose of everything. Because to an ignorant person, just a simple ignorant person, most people like that, if you brought up about God, they would agree. They wouldn't think to do something in connection with God. They wouldn't think how to do it or know how to do it. But if you brought it up that the reason we're suffering is because we're not, you know, bringing our activities in line with God. And most likely that so-called ignorant or uneducated person would agree. Right? Because they know I'm ignorant. But now the educated, so-called educated, in this advanced modern education, they become very, very educated. Or even in the Vedic, where it's godless, right? The impersonalist, they know so much about what's going on that they definitely leave God out of it. And you say, well, God's there. No, but there's an explanation. Right? No, there's some science or some other thing behind it. Or if they're following the Vedas, then, well, ultimately it's all one, so it doesn't matter. So this is more dangerous. Because then the common man who could be easily, is already basically a personalist, like that, could be just, you can just upgrade his personalness, right? You know, now he's working at, you know, program personal, you know, 0.001. You know, you can bring it up to a proper number. You know, because you bring into it actually God, who himself is, who others are in that relationship. So he's still just seeing work, right? But now he can relate to religion, and religion is work. So he can perform his religious duties and see God in it. But the impersonalist, then the academic, then the difficulty is then they already have so many ideas that are separate from God. Right? The other doesn't. He's in ignorance, so he doesn't even think. These people think. Nice that they think, that they're intelligent, that's great. So if you can convince them, then you have something very valuable. But if you can't convince them, then they're more dangerous. Right? Your common man is ignorant. He knows it's better. You get one of these educated, you get them to understand, then they can convince so many ignorant men. But if they're not convinced, then they can misguide so many ignorant men like that. So therefore they're more dangerous like that.
Yes. Could you say that the how you define the Vedic perspective, it's coming from the celestials, whereas the modern is coming from here. And just when you're talking about these ignorant people, there's the example that they're inclined to look up at the sky at night and see all of the things and see it's great, something must have made that. Mm-hmm. Or somebody who's educated, they pontificate about it.
Yeah, no, they'll say that, you know, the star and the this and the black holes and the dwarf and, you know, this and the different solar systems and like that. But here is, you have, there's only one thing. You know, they'll talk about many suns and many, no, those are stars. And that effulgence that they have is because of the piety of the living entities on that planet. So it's either the person who's the head of that planet, or it's individuals who are on the planet. But that says that, because when Arjuna then goes with Matali up to the heavenly planets, you know, Indra's charioteer, then as he's going, he's seeing all these effulgent people going around in their chariots and all that. And he asks in all these different places, and he asks, what is all this? And he says, these are all, you know, the heavenly regions, these are all the greatly pious people that live here. He says, on earth, you'll know them as stars. Like that. So when you look up, you see all these stars. But when you're up there, you see people and places. It's just that their piety is so great that they're effulgent, so you see. You know, so many things that they're unable to appreciate. That actually, what is the point of that? Because we see is that it'll come up when we study Upanishad. is that you have Brahman, Paramatman, and Bhagavan. So then they have residences, right, where they reside. So Krishna, I mean, Bhagavan, he resides in the spiritual world. Right? Paramatma resides in the material world. Right? He's here in this place. That's where you'll find him. Right? And Brahman resides in light. So we understand from other quotations that this Brahman is the light coming from Krishna's qualities. Because Krishna has these 64 qualities, an unlimited amount. Therefore, the effulgence of that, that's the Brahman. Right? So actually, it's based on qualities. Right? Because you can say, oh, it's nice, it's good, it's peaceful, it's this, but it still doesn't have, it is connected to a person, but it not actually is personal. That's why it's impersonal. Because the person then you have an interaction with. There's a relationship. But here is just you can appreciate the quality, this, that. So therefore anyone with qualities is effulgent. Does that make sense? And when somebody lacks, like they're in good mood, this, that, they're effulgent. When that's not there, then they become dark. You know, like that. So that effulgence is based on qualities. You know, that's interesting. That's the point we're making here. The full discussion of this will come up in the thematic study of the Upanishad. Okay. Is that okay? So we'll end here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samavita Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanand. Not higher here is just what's the upper and what's the lower.
Upper,
he used higher in that, that's upper and lower.
Yeah.
Because it means which is superior here, the table or the rock?
The table?
Yeah, because it's holding up the rock. So therefore, it's not necessarily the lower principle.
Yeah, I mean,
less.
I used. But how is.
You can't understand how the teacher is the basis.
Oh, he is the basis.
Yeah.
But what does it mean? The disciple is superior principle and the teacher is...
Why do you go back to that word?
I mean, but the word is
because
is
he
the definition.
Used that because now you're stuck with that. Is that it? But I told you
he
what
used
it meant.
He used it. Because you didn't correct him, I thought it's correct.
No. The point is upper. Then I explained it. The basis. So
basis.
Therefore, that's always more.
Maharaj, can you allow us to attend your Mahabharata classes, me and this boy?
Right now, it's only those who are in the school that are going because. The problem comes is that if there's people that that the students don't know, then they become shy, and then they don't ask questions.
Okay.
So the whole idea is it's just only the students, so then and only the teachers that work with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even other teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so many teachers are there, but only the ones that actually work with them, then, because they're used to them. Then, because otherwise we had before, it was everybody could come, but then the kids stopped asking questions and all of that because they felt shy. So therefore, then we kind of become yeah.
I have this problem with this boy because he is still not admitted to the school. So I'm working with him. I don't know how to do. Just he's visiting our this class.